Wherever you are on your leadership voyage, it starts here.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Leadership Voyage. My name is Jason Wick, and I'm happy that you've tuned in to the podcast dedicated to your pursuit of becoming a great leader. Apologies in advance. My voice is waning a little bit here today after being sick last week. You can contact the podcast, startyourvoyage@gmail.com. Visit the website, leadership.voyage. If you want to help me with my mission, which is to help more people in the world become better leaders, just take a minute, if you don't mind, go to the wherever you got this podcast, put in a rating, write a review, share it with a friend. I do mean it. It's really important to me, but don't do it for me. Do it for all the other folks out there who are trying to become better leaders on their journey, just like you are. It would mean a lot to me and a lot to them. It'll help spread the word about the show. So if you could take 60 seconds and do that, I would really appreciate it. So we are here today with the third episode of season two to talk with Liz Wiseman. I am so excited to share this conversation with you. Who is Liz Wiseman, if you're not familiar? Perk your ears up right now, because she's a researcher and executive advisor who teaches leadership to executives all around the world. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller Multipliers, The Multiplier Effect, and the Wall Street Journal bestsellers Rookie Smarts and Impact Players. Liz is the CEO of the Wiseman Group, a leadership research and development firm in Silicon Valley that's had clients such as Apple, AT&T, Disney, Facebook, Microsoft, Nike, Salesforce, Tesla, Twitter. She has received the Top Achievement Award for Leadership from Thinkers 50 and is consistently named one of the world's top 50 management thinkers. Hello, do I have your attention? You're going to learn a whole lot of valuable stuff from this conversation with Liz. How we embrace a rookie mindset and find top performance from that. What does it mean to provide the most impact, to become an impact player? What do those folks bring to the table on a daily basis? There is so much value in this conversation. I cannot wait to share it with you. But before we do that, let's not forget about our affiliate, Instacart. You can click the link in the show notes and let them know that we sent you. When you go to Instacart, you can get the products that you love from your local stores delivered to your door in as fast as an hour. Instacart highlights the deals that'll help you save money. You can find everything that you usually buy, get smart suggestions for new items, and they pick the freshest produce and keep your eggs safe too. If you're in a mood where you're not ready to go out today, but you still need some groceries, check out the link in the show notes. I encourage you to give Instacart a try. I myself am a customer. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Liz Wiseman. All right. Well, welcome, everybody, to another episode of Leadership Voyage. I am here with Liz Wiseman. It is really nice to meet you, Liz.
Well, it's good to be here. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Good. Thanks, Liz. And I truly am humbled to have your audience. Thank you so much. I look forward to this conversation. I thought we'd start off with something hard hitting. I realized we were supposed to talk last week. I had the flu or something nasty. And so now we're meeting today, February 2nd. What are your thoughts on Groundhog Day?
Oh, Groundhog Day. You know, I would put it in like daylight savings practices that someone thought we needed, but I'm just not sure really what the point is. Like, this is one where I'm like, can someone really explain to me why this is so important? But I'm sure it is.
I don't even know the history, but I was thinking of the metaphor if the calendar of holidays were the states in the U.S., I feel like Groundhog Day would be a flyover state. You know, it's just something that doesn't have a whole lot of significance to me. I don't know if Punxsutawney Phil saw his shadow today or not, but I doubt you do either based on your initial
response. I haven't been waiting for the news with bated breath, but I live in a more temperate climate, so maybe
fair enough.
All right. Well, now to the easy stuff. So again, I'm really humbled to have you here today. You know, for those who aren't aware, the Thinkers 50 list is this really cool list that comes out every year or two. And Liz, you're one of those folks mentioned on it as one of the 50 most influential people out there for management and business. And it's just a very cool list to be on. And you've written some very influential books. Rookie Smarts, Multipliers, Impact Players, I think is the most recent here in 2021. And if you're okay, I'd like to start with this concept of rookie smarts for everybody. When I've seen you talk about a rookie mindset or thinking like a rookie, you're talking about someone who's being stretched, put in a growth position. I'm kind of wondering if you could give us kind of the rundown of what are the conditions most conducive to kind of foster growth and be in this rookie mindset. What's it all about?
Well, the premise behind the concept of rookie smarts is that we often are at our very best when we know the very least. You know, we think, oh man, you don't want to be a rookie. Like so many people are striving for expertise. Like when you have developed expertise, you've arrived. But you know, with expertise comes a lot of, I guess what I would call adult onset learning disabilities. Like, you know, like we're capable of learning, but we build these layers of protection or like filters that prevent us from seeing things that we used to be able to see. And, you know, my research on this showed that we do tend to outperform experts when we're in rookie mode, not in everything, certainly not in physical skills. Like, you know, you put me down and the all-star game NBA is like, I'm not gonna suddenly develop hops, you know? And of course you don't want a rookie surgeon or a skydiving partner. Like, you know,
yeah, right.
There are places where you very much want to know that someone's done this more than zero. But when it comes to cognitive tasks and how we approach things, we find that we tend to excel when we're new. And it's not because of this kind of popular refrain that, well, we bring fresh ideas. What I actually found was in some ways the opposite. Our value when we're new to something is that we bring no ideas. And it's what happens when we got nothing, when there's kind of like visitor or home team 50, visitor zero, like when we've got no points on the board, it creates a certain drive in us. It's this drive to find answers. It's a drive to make a contribution when you haven't. It's a humility, a willingness to take feedback. You know, I go from corporation to corporation trying to help, you know, them develop leadership skills and contribution skills. And everyone wants people to be open to feedback. Well, I'll tell you who's open to feedback. Desperate people are open to feedback, you know, newcomers. And it's kind of like, you know, when you get that intern and they're like, how am I doing? How am I doing? Am I doing? Am I doing it right? Is this what you want? And we develop this openness, this humility, this willing to ask questions, to ask naive questions, a willingness to adjust and adapt our behavior, a willingness to suggest things that nobody else would. So it's not just that we bring new ideas, it's we bring drive. And when I was looking at what the research showed that rookies do as compared to their, you know, experienced counterparts, I'm like, wow, this list of behaviors is all the behaviors corporations are trying to inculcate in their workforce. They're the behaviors we're trying to teach, you know, in school. Like, and in some ways, you know, it creates this persona that we want to get ourselves back into.
Interesting.
And there's sort of two ways to get ourselves back into this mode. One is, you know, to keep thinking like a rookie. Like, okay, how would I approach this if I've never done it before? The other way is what I call the lazy way, and it's absolutely my way. And that is to just keep saying yes to things you don't know how to do. It's to like situationally force yourself into rookie mode. And, you know, I guess another way to answer your question is, what are the situations that are conducive to growth? Mm-hmm. Well, there's this power combination, which is people who have high self-confidence, but very low situational confidence. Because if you just get competent people, they can just bumble right through things. Like, I got this figured out, boom. And they can make a mess of it. But if you get people who are like new to something and they're like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, that's not going to help either. But if you can put someone with strong self-confidence, like, I'm smart, I'm capable, like, you know, growth mindset is probably part of this. And you put them in a situation and they have the sensitivity and self-awareness to recognize, like, you are in a new situation. Your confidence should be low right now. But they're operating on a strong base of like self-confidence, like legit. That's a power combination that fosters growth and high performance.
Great answer. And if I also remember you talking about some of the characteristics that you see from people who are in rookie mode, you said something like they're asking 3 or 5 times as many questions as someone who is in the maybe the expert mindset. I love the recipe you just outlined. You have good self-confidence, but I think, did you say situational, lower situational confidence, which I suggest you're not familiar, I suppose, right?
Right. And it's like being a confident world traveler, like, okay, like I know how to navigate, but I'm in a new country right now and I don't know how to navigate here. I don't know what that head nod means here. I don't know. So, you know, and it's like drawing on things that we do know, but recognizing that we have to go into like heightened learning mode. Yeah, I guess it's like heightened learning mode coupled with a sense that we can learn.
Yes, I love it.
It tends to be a pretty powerful combination.
Love it. So you talked about a couple ways to have those conducive conditions. One, forcing yourself to think like a rookie. Two, just say yes to everything, as you said, maybe in a way. Let's take this situation for a minute and kind of look at the system maybe that contributors might be inside of. And in a lot of people's cases, they have a manager who is giving them work, giving them opportunities. I can think like a rookie all day and hopefully that's my ticket. But on the other side, maybe I don't have a lot of things to say yes to all the time, okay? Mm-hmm. So as a manager, I might be hesitant to hand out rookie opportunities.
Sure.
Because I'm comfortable. I'm a manager. I'm comfortable with my known commodities, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice to maybe a manager who is really valuing or overvaluing this predictability, efficiency of giving people opportunities that it look more known and predictable than handing others rookie mode opportunities?
Working extremes, like if there's a natural pull, one, to give things to people that they absolutely know how to do. There's no risk involved. It's in their wheelhouse. They're experts. Go. But you don't want to swing to the other extreme, which is, hey, let me just give this to some like newcomer and like pray for good results.
Sure.
You know, it's recognizing that we tend to be at our best when we are working on the outer edge of what we know how to do. Like in that liminal space. So if you are reluctant to just say, hey, you know what? You're new here. Try this. We've all been unsuccessful at it. Like, I don't recommend going there. Number one, look for that liminal space where it's like, this person has some of the core capabilities. They have some like natural skills that make them competent in this space. But now I'm going to ask them to do something in that ring, kind of that outer growth ring.
Yeah.
Because then it's like, okay, this is an extension of what I know how to do, but I clearly don't know how to do it. One, if you want to increase the likelihood that people are going to excel in this rookie space, let them know it's a rookie space. Because it's going to be very easy to, you know, me to go, okay, I got this. I know how to do it. It's like, hey, Liz, you're good at this, or you've done things like this, but this is new. This is new for all of us. You're smart, you can figure it out, but like right here, this is kind of a new situation. So this is a good time to like kind of get your rookie on.
Yeah, love it. So by identifying that that's the type of situation we're going into, maybe it even creates a more safe environment for them to go into rookie mode, asking those questions, make no assumptions, all those different types of things as well.
Jason, I think you're exactly right on this, because not only does it create more safety for the leader, which is like, hello, like treat this with caution, you know, work like a rookie. It also creates safety for that person, which is, hey, you're going to make some mistakes. You're going to bumble a little bit. We expect that. So I think it creates safety for them to be willing to stretch, to look at it in nonlinear ways. Other things that I would recommend managers do is, you know, one pivot at a time, rather than, you know, like, okay, here's something that's entirely new. It's like, you know what, this is like a step in a different direction for you. Like, let's say you've led, you know, marketing efforts in tech companies. It's like, okay, well, you know what, I'm going to give you a chance to lead a marketing effort in a nonprofit company, but we're not going to put you in finance in nonprofit when you just came from marketing and tech. Or the other way around. Like, those are two different pivots, one pivot at a time. And I think fundamentally, and I think this is one of the true art forms of great leadership, is knowing how to size that stretch right. You know, how do you give someone kind of a stretch challenge? One that's going to make them very uncomfortable, one that's going to make them wobble, one that's going to make them their situational confidence drop down. Something that'll stretch them, but not break them.
Stretch, but not break. Yeah.
And, you know, often we have observations about that, but in some ways, the best way to know what that like optimal size stretch is just to ask people, like, what's the challenge you wish you were given? Like, yeah, what's something that we could give to you that would stretch you, but not break you? What's something that would make you give you low situational confidence, but actually where you would still have self-confidence. It wouldn't terrify you.
What I love about this though too, Liz, is, I mean, so often, and maybe it's more in my own mind, but so often in management, it's like we feel like we have to be tinkering behind the curtain and find the way to make it all work. I love what you're saying in your examples is, oh, just talk to the employee, say, hey, we might try this and it's going to be your rookie moment. Or, hey, what will bend you or stretch you, but not break you? I love how you're just saying, just talk to them, like almost like we're normal human beings or something, right? I mean, I
just ask, you know, okay, I'm going to tell you a little secret. One of my secrets from, you know, my early days as an executive coach, where honestly, I didn't entirely know what I was doing. You know, you got to have your first few kind of clients / victims. But there was one thing I noticed when I would be sitting across the desk from an executive, and these were people who are running big, complex operations with lots of complex challenges. I would often hear them describe, well, see, the problem is if I do that and I give that person like more responsibility, it's going to create this dynamic over here. And then these people are going to be mad and there's going to be like a little mutiny here. And then and they would describe all that. And, you know, of course, not entirely knowing how to solve that problem, I would find myself asking, well, what would happen if you told that person, like if you just laid out your logic and told them why that person's like, oh, you know what, we're giving, you know, Frank more responsibility because da 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 da. And the answer always came back, well, that would solve the problem. And so my very fancy coaching would be, well, why don't you just tell them?
Love it.
And, you know, so many problems are solved when we just tell people what we're thinking. We tell people what we're concerned about. We tell people what we hope is going to happen. Or we just ask people, like, what do you think you can do next?
That's so good. And it really is collaborative when you talk about it that way, too, which I really like. That's great.
Well, it breaks down this power differential that makes those relationships dysfunctional.
Totally. Well, good. Thanks. That's a good... I kind of love some of those discussions around rookie mode and rookie smarts. And I want to pivot a little bit here to some of the stuff that's going on in your latest book, Impact Players. Could you tell us a little bit about the methodology and the kind of the interview process of what went on with Impact Players as you're trying to understand what some of the most impactful contributors at organizations are doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we set out to really understand, you know, what makes some people get stuck going through the motions, while other people who are no smarter, you know, no more capable, no harder working, why do they end up breaking through and making a big impact where other people get stuck? That's what we're trying to figure out. And we went out to 170 managers across 9 different organizations. So I was at like roughly 20-ish per organization. And we asked them to identify 2 contributors. And this is at various levels. This could be like individual contributors to, you know, senior leaders that they had managed, that they had had leadership responsibility for. And we asked them to identify 2 people, both of whom were smart, capable, and hardworking. One of whom was doing fine work and one of whom was making a significant impact. Now, in half the interviews, we actually had them contrast the person who's making a significant impact with someone who was smart, capable, and hardworking, but was what I considered to be under-contributing, meaning they were really, really capable, but strangely, in some ways inexplicably, they're contributing way below their capability level. Yeah. Almost like the person on paper who just looks amazing. And then they're like, why are they off, like going right when everyone else is going left? Yeah. So we really made these 3 comparisons. I focused in the book really on the difference between people who are doing a rock solid, fine job, the rock solid contributors versus the impact players. And really what we're trying to do is understand the differences in how they think and what they do and the impact they have on others and the organization. And, you know, I think what we found was that, for starters, the managers in aggregate ascribed the value to the work done by the impact players as 3.5 times greater than the ordinary contributors who were anything but ordinary.
Right,
and I think that was the other thing that I found is that these ordinary contributors, these are not like lackeys.
Right, right.
These are people who do their job. They do. And I was fascinated by this description, like in aggregate of the ordinary contributor. They're like, oh, yeah, you know what? Like Marcus, like, he does his job. He does his job well. He's so good at what he does. I'm thinking
that sounds pretty good.
That sounds pretty good. And he would be like, well, they're team players. They play nice in the sandbox. They follow direction. These are people who are focused, who, you know, carry their weight on teams, who take responsibility and ownership for things. I'm like, that sounds like an ideal team member, contributor, like someone you'd want to hire. And what I began to see is that the ordinary contributor was absolutely stellar in ordinary times. But when things started to get ambiguous, uncertain, a little chaotic, that's where the impact players, as I call them, think about and handle situations very, very differently than kind of the rock solid contributor.
And I know that, to give the full list of what differentiates that impact player in those uncommon times, you just say, go read the book. Thank you very much. But as a broad question, what are a couple of things that an impact player typically is doing in these ambiguous, uncertain times that you might see, again, a rock solid contributor? You're not comparing an underperformer necessarily here to an impact player, just they do a good job, but this impact player who's thriving, not just surviving in ambiguous times, what are a couple or 3 things that they do that are different?
Well, there are 5 that popped out of the research. Stop me at any one point when we get to know, and I'm happy to explain it. I think when I was a first-time author, I would just say like, oh, go read the book. Like, I worked really hard to write this up. Like, the book is way better than anything I could explain. Now I realize there are way too many books in the world and people aren't necessarily going to go read the book. So the first is how they handle messy problems. Problems without clear owners. Like, I don't know, it's not marketing's issue. It's not sales issue. It's like somehow sitting in the middle of all of this. And what we find is the ordinary contributor, they do their job and they do their job well. The impact player does the job that needs to be done.
And that was the line that I remember. Sorry if I interrupted you. That is what I took away remembering in that part of the book. The impact player does the job that needs to be done over doing their job, which is a very interesting sentence to read. I kind of stopped for a second. But you're right. You have these moments where something's teetering, maybe between 2 lines of responsibility in your example here of sales or marketing. No one we'll take action perhaps if we're only looking at the definitions that exist for us on paper, right?
Right. And you think about the organization is a snapshot in time. It's like an org chart and job descriptions. We need it to avoid total chaos in large organizations. But what it's done, we organize for like work that's been important in the past. But work that's important today tends to be what's new, what's still ill-defined, it's liminal, and that we haven't yet organized for. And that's what's important. It's kind of like every time I go through TSA security in the airport, I always think, this is such a perfectly designed system for last year's security threats.
Okay, right.
But not necessarily a great system for like the kinds of threats that are on the horizon. So like when you're doing your job, in some ways you are addressing yesterday's priorities. Our org charts can't quite capture and scoop in like what's important right now. And so I'm not saying one should forsake their job and just go chase like what's important, but I think we notice that the impact players, they're outward oriented. They're thinking about what's important. So like they're looking at the work of an organization, be it a school, a business, a symphony, and they're kind of like, okay, what's hot right now? What's a hot topic? What's a hot project? What's a hot button for my team, for my leader? And they're just looking for heat. And when they see sort of heat, that's like hot spots that are not being addressed and they have capability, they flow towards them.
I don't know if you've read Carly Fiorina's, one of her books. I can't remember what it was called right now. It's on my shelf right there. I can almost see it. She said something in there about, you know, you want people who run towards problems. And that visual kind of always stuck with me. And kind of now that you're saying people, they're looking for the heat and attracted to the heat, it strikes me as a very similar, maybe a similar idea.
Yeah. And Carly's a great example, having been the CEO of, you know, HP. It's like there's an organization in place, but every day, like the CEO is learning about, well, okay, that's an issue that fell through the cracks. Like we're not set up to do this. And either someone like a Carly will have to figure out, okay, here's all this like random hot things. And I have to like delegate that and then follow up and see if it got done. Imagine the gift of having people on your team who are like, you know what? Not only do I see a problem and then claim it and say, I'll go after it. Like I'm going to go after it and then tell my boss that it's solved.
Right.
Like these people are gold inside of organizations.
And that really, that captures the meaning of the word impact in my mind as you're saying that, right? It's already, it doesn't even surface until you can say, hey, I found that and it's all good. We're good. What is another trait or another attribute of an impact player that maybe you could tell us about?
Well, a second one would be how they deal with unclear roles. And, you know, the ordinary contributor, they are willing to embrace that role. They're willing to embrace leadership roles. Like they're willing leaders, but they're leaders in waiting. They're waiting for somebody to appoint them or anoint them. It's like, hey, I'm willing to lead that initiative, that project, or just this meeting, but they're waiting for somebody above them to say, hey, Liz, you're in charge. It's almost like, hey, I'll be happy to do that. Could you send out an email to everyone on the team and tell people I'm the boss?
Right.
Versus the impact player, when they see these leadership vacuums, they are very quick to just step up and fulfill that role. But they're not the kind of land grabbers who always have to be in charge. Because we all know the people who are like, need to be in the lead all the time. Mm-hmm. And actually, they're not that influential in organizations because we're very suspicious of them.
Yeah, definitely.
So they're, you know, where the ordinary contributor is waiting for direction, the impact player is stepping up and taking charge. But then when they've kind of fulfilled that leadership need, they roll back and they support other people. And it's very much like a flock of migrating geese, where there's not a single bird that leads in that V formation that allows a flock to fly so efficiently. It's one bird flies to the front, kind of does that, takes that extra load of breaking the wind and creating that drag. But then when that bird tires, it falls back and another one takes over. It's this very fluid orientation to leader. It's like leader's not a job. It's a temporary role. It's ephemeral. Appreciate people who step up and lead, but then we appreciate that they step back and follow their colleagues with as much ease and grace. Like, these are wonderful people to work around, and we give them power.
I think what's coming along with all of that extra description you're providing us is, you know, it is someone who is a team player, right? I mean, they are someone who is situationally aware and context driven and a team player as well. Because I do think it can be easy, you know, you have all these constructs and organizations. What do you need to do to make an impact? But what do you need to do to be a good teammate and all these different things? And it's just interesting to hear you describe an impact player, because they kind of encompass so many of these things already, but they're doing it proactively. They're doing it without direction, right?
And that's probably the big thing. It's they're behaving in the ways that we see so many organizations asking people to work and behave, but they're doing it voluntarily and without someone telling them to do it. And when I look kind of at the aggregate, like behavior and mindsets of impact players, and I look at this other data we gathered, which is asking managers, what is it that people do that make your job so easy, so delightful? What, you know, do people do that builds their credibility? And then we look at, what do people do that, you know, you really hate, makes your job leading miserable? And, you know, people initially in the interviews are like, oh, I don't really have anything. I'm like, oh yeah, you do. And then they're like, well, now that you mention it, like, I hate it when people do this, this, and this. When I step back and looked at all of that, what it became so clear is that managers don't like managing. What they hate doing is telling people what to do. You know, and a lot of people talk like, oh yeah, my boss is like a bully and micromanager, like a dictator. It's like, most managers hate telling people what to do. They hate following up to see if people have done it. And what they love is people who see a problem and go solve a problem, who anticipate needs and fix it, who follow up without being done. Like, we love people. NASA has such a great term for this. They call it fire and forget. And it is not fire people and forget about them. It's different. It's certain people are fire and forget kind of people, meaning you can fire off a request to them and then you can forget about it because you know that it is as good as done.
Going to be done.
Yeah. And that's what really builds influence and credibility, is when it's essentially what managers want are people who are self-managing. Really, yeah, managers don't seem to want to manage anymore, which is, I think, great, but no one wants to be managed anymore. And so what it creates this really valuable proposition is, if we can self-manage, it's our ticket out of being micromanaged. And when we can like direct ourselves, then we now get leadership opportunities and bigger opportunities. And we allow our managers to get out of the micromanaging business that they don't seem to like either.
So managers don't want to micromanage. Individuals don't want to be managed. We'd prefer to self-direct. And we're saying that an impact player is someone who is going to be more in this realm of these behaviors. And you say early in the book, you know, because I will say, just kind of jotting down the notes, you know, when you hear someone's making a 3.5 times bigger impact than someone else, you know, oh, give me a bunch of these people. But you say early in the book, no, don't kid yourself. You're not going to read this book and then you're just going to have a formula where you can quickly take all 8 of your employees and turn them into impact players. It's a lot of hard work to maybe nurture these behaviors. Give us a hint. What's one small thing somebody can do, or a manager could do, to encourage somebody showing more of these behaviors? What can we do?
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, I don't know, it's a lot of hard work for Ben. Okay. I know there's no syrup you can give people that will magically turn them into impact players, but there are some things you can do to help people in that direction. So one is to let people know what are high impact behaviors.
Here we go again, just telling them the information.
Just man. Tell them, like, or even like state what you appreciate. Like, when you solve problems without me having to tell me, what it allows me to do is, you know, go off doing this, we can respond faster. Like, thank you. Sharing that profile of impact players with people is a good start. But I think a lot of it comes down to, are you the kind of manager that deserves impact players? Are you the kind of manager these super talented high contributors would want to work for? Or are you the kind of manager that would enable people to step up and to play big and to take responsibility? It's a rangy and risky way of working. And so I would encourage managers not just think, well, okay, how do I just hire these people? Or how do I like poof them into working this way? It's like, how do I create an environment where they can? And my experience is absolutely that all people, most people who haven't been like damaged by the workplace to a point where they can't recover, you know, most people want to work this way, yeah. Being more self-directed. You know, we want to be difference makers, not position holders. But there's two things that managers can do to create that environment. And this really comes from my research studying these multiplier leaders, leaders who bring out people's best, leaders who allow people to play really big around them. And it's creating two simultaneous conditions. One is safety and the other is stretch. In some ways, one of the most powerful things you can do as a leader is just simply to give people permission to work this way. Don't get too uptight about your job description. Like if you see a job that needs to be done, like you can venture out of these artificial constraints. Like if you're in a leaderless meeting, don't be afraid to raise your hand and just say, hey, would it be helpful if I guide us through this discussion for the next 60 minutes? And so on. So a lot of it is people will work this way if you make it safe for people to work this way. And the other is stretch, is to give them stretch challenges, invite them to work outside of their area of responsibility or expertise, or simply to have the discipline to not do it for them. A lot of managers are operating under this model, which is, okay, my job is to do the hard stuff.
Okay, yeah.
In fact, I have to admit, this would come in like the worst advice category that I ever received in my career. So when I was a new manager, my boss said to me, he goes, Liz, as a manager, your job is to do everything that is new, important, and hard. Oof. He said, let your team do the rest. I did that. And so if like, you know, a hot issue came in, I handled it. And I let my team handle more of the quotidian kind of work. And then, you know, fast forward a few months, I'm off doing all the high profile stuff. And my team is stuck just kind of going through the motions. And I'm like, oh, well, who's hogging all the development for herself? Me. I'm building skills like mad. I'm building influence and credibility like mad. And people under me are just sort of letting me handle all of that. And I'm like, well, it was the worst leadership advice I had ever been given. Like, if you want impact players, give people things that are hard. Let them go in those messy spaces, difficult conversations. Now, don't, you know, size that challenge right.
Yeah, back to the rookie smarts kind of discussion. Size it right, give them the right stretch, right, on the periphery, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. So I love this. You're giving them permission outright, having that conversation. That sounds great. Saying, hey, you have your job description, but you have permission to seek out the hot spots, as you've said earlier, which does give them safety in these types of decisions on their own. It's okay if you went for something and it didn't go perfectly, provide that safe space. And also concurrently give them stretch opportunities. Don't hoard all the hard work, as you're saying. Mm-hmm. These are some things managers can do.
Well, there's so many things what managers can give people permission to do. One of the third difference is how impact players handle unforeseen obstacles, like the things that are beyond your control. And what we find is an ordinary contributor tends to, when they take ownership, they move it forward. But when they come to that big boulder, like they tend to escalate up, like, oh, this one's bigger than me. I need to like alert the higher ups, hand it off to the higher ups. And the impact players, they just hold on to it longer, but they don't, it's not like they handle the problem all by themselves. What they do is they stay in the lead and then they pull in reinforcements. So that model of working is, I'm going to hold on to it, but I need help and I need help from the higher up. So I'm going to get the higher ups essentially working for me.
Yeah.
Right. Which some people are like people like me who are kind of, I think, born bossy, you know, naturally kind of like, oh, that's great. I'm happy to get like the senior executives like working for me. Great. Perfect day at work. But for other people, that's terrifying. And it's easier to say, okay, senior VP, off to you. But as a leader, you can say, you know what? If you encounter something big, it's hard, you know, like, let me know, but let me know how I can help you get this done.
An impact player, if I'm hearing you correctly, they're not handing it off. They're continuing to handle with support.
With support. And so what you have to give people permission to do is to keep holding on to it, but you have to give people permission to lead their leaders.
No.
Because if they don't have the permission, let's say it's a critical account and something's just gone wrong and $1 million deal drops out of your pipeline, you can either be like, okay, here you go. Like you can go in and try to like save this with the customer. You're like, okay, I'm on it. But you know what? Could you make a phone call here? Do you think maybe you could help get, you know, this group to arrange for a discount? Like you're still in charge, but you're getting other people to pull along with you. And, you know, being a little bossy of one's bosses requires some safety. Like give people permission to lead you if you want them to stay in the lead.
That's great. I love that. That's something I certainly think, I know personally, boy, I could totally overlook just the notion of having to grant that permission or give someone that safety, you know, they might be uncomfortable with that concept. That's a great point to call out, Liz. Thank you. We've gotten some good insights here on a rookie mindset, impact players. I think anyone listening here can pick any of a handful of things that they might want to go act on. And we're all about learning here and learning how to be better leaders. And that's why I ask everybody the same question at the end. It doesn't have to do with your work at all. It's up to you. But the same question I ask all my guests is, what is something that you've learned recently?
I'll give you something I learned today.
Okay. That's pretty recent.
My grandson's here. Okay. And my grandson loves his grandma and he's always reaching out once like me. And I just learned today that he doesn't love grandma necessarily any more than anyone else. He just thinks grandma's his ride outside. Like I learned, oh, he reaches for me because he thinks I'm going to bust him out of here and take him outside to like where the real action is. He's got this association. I'm like, I thought he really loved me, but he's just, that little one-year-old is using me, bust out of jail. So anyway, I learned that today, but I'll tell you one of the things I've learned over the last couple of weeks is, and it's like kind of, I think, the core idea that's come from this book, The Good Life, and written by Dr. Bob Wallinger, who was, you know, one of the lead researchers on this longitudinal study about out of Harvard, about this group of people and how they've experienced life. And the conclusion is that people who have really solid, strong relationships tend to experience more longevity and greater well-being in life. That longevity and well-being is as much of a function of like emotional connection as it is, I don't know how many sit-ups you do or how many packs of cigarette you smoke. In fact, I think I even read in there that a strong relationship counteracts like, smoking a half a pack of cigarette a day, like it neutralizes that.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, I think a lot of us have known this intuitively, but it's a pretty good reminder that, you know, seek out relationships and be available.
Especially after some of the distances after these pandemic times, you know, with disconnections. And it is a good reminder to hear that, the value of that. So don't put off anything today that you're waiting to tell somebody. Nurture that relationship, everybody. Liz Wiseman said so.
Well, it's not me. There's a lot of researchers who have done this, but they also found that it's not just having a number of like strong intimate relationships. It's the power of casual relationships.
Oh, interesting.
And it's the power of just talking to people as you brush up against them in the world, like people on vacation, people at restaurants, someone in the, you know, the Uber driver. And I think it's something that we get busy and forget to do. I know I am guilty of just sort of being so preoccupied that I forget that, oh yeah, these other people around me, like we're coexisting in this space, and just slow down.
So seeing the importance and acknowledging the importance and how they matter and the people that you encounter in your day. Well, Liz, thanks for your note there about what you've learned recently. And thanks for all the great discussions about your books and your research. And thank you so much for giving us some of your time today. I know that lots of people are going to get a lot of good information out of it. So thank you so much for your time this afternoon. It means a lot.
Well, Jason, thank you. Thanks for the invitation and the good insights from you. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. I was talking to my neighbor who listens to the podcast, and he gave me some really nice feedback. He said, you know what would be cool is if you wrapped up the episode with just kind of a summary of all the things that happened. So I thought I'd try that for the first time here with Season 2, Episode 3. So again, as a reminder, the Leadership Voyage podcast, you can reach us at startyourvoyage@gmail.com. The website is leadership.voyage. And, of course, please rate and review it wherever you are listening to your podcasts. Today's guest was Liz Wiseman, thewisemangroup.com. If you're interested to all that Liz is up to and learning more about her books and her consulting group. And the stuff that we talked about today, we talked about rookie mode, right? We talked about how rookies outperform experts when they're in that mindset. A couple of ways that you can get into rookie mode is, one, just try to train yourself to think like a rookie, and two, say yes to things that you don't yet know how to do. That the powerful combination for people in rookie mode are folks who have high self-confidence but low situational confidence, and this is a powerful combination. As managers, if you're working with someone and trying to give them those rookie mode opportunities, just go ahead and be open with them and tell them that it's rookie time. Manage that change carefully, one pivot at a time for them. We also talked about impact players. Why did these folks have a bigger impact, a 3.5 times impact compared to ordinary employees, when they're really no smarter than the ordinary contributor? And it's because ordinary contributors are stellar in ordinary times, but impact players are able to handle messy problems without clear owners. They handle unclear roles and fill those leadership vacuums, step back when it's all stable again. And they're able to handle unforeseen obstacles. They tend to handle the challenge with support a little bit longer than your ordinary contributor, who is more likely to hand things off when they are a really big challenge. If managers are trying to help others become closer to this idea of an impact player, we can tell them what are the high impact behaviors. Just be direct on that. Show them what you appreciate about their behaviors. Give them safety to go for it and not nail it perfectly every time, and provide opportunities to help them stretch. Give them hard things while sizing it right. So that's a summary of today's episode. I look forward to next time on Leadership Voyage.